From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last November when Connor Dwyer Reynolds was confirmed as the executive director of the Rochester Police Accountability Board. Reynolds wrote in a memo at the time that the board would indeed be independent in its operations and in its hiring. Some members of Rochester City Council raised some concern about that. Well, fast forward to earlier this month. With the PAB ready to make numerous hires, the question of autonomy came up again. Initially, City Council took the position that any new hires had to be approved by Council's president. The PAB said simply, that would mean we are not independent, and how are we going to do our jobs if we are not independent? Well, 3 days later, things changed. City Council President Loretta Scott walked back her earlier statements and agreed that the PAB could hire whom it pleased. It's not a small matter. All across the country, there are questions of how to evaluate police conduct. Just about everywhere, there are fights over independence and autonomy. The PAB in Rochester has asserted for a long time that it must not be beholden to city or police leaders. So what happens next? Will it be truly independent? And what hires can the PAB now make? Our guest this hour is the executive director of the Rochester Police Accountability Board, Connor Dwyer Reynolds. Nice to see you in studio. Thank you for being here.
Always great to be here, Evan.
And later this hour, we expect to talk to the chair of the PAB, Shawnee Wilson. But let's go back to last November. I mean, you wrote in that memo, it was clear to you from the jump that you were going to need autonomy. What did that mean to you then?
Well, you know, if you read the law that Rochesterians overwhelmingly voted to support back in 2019, and one of the first things it says is that PAB is an independent office of city government and an autonomous office of city government. You know, we're within the city government, we're city employees, all that, but we are separate, not just from the Rochester Police Department, but we're also separate from some of those, political control. That's what it is. We still have oversight. City Council still sets our budget, still looks into, you know, our operations, can audit us, et cetera. There's still proper oversight. It's just the day-to-day operations, our decisions about what we investigate, how we investigate, and when. That has to be given to us. And so, you know, when I took this job, the charter was pretty clear, saw it. And, you know, I think when I first started the job, there was obviously a little bit of maybe misunderstanding about what that charter said and how we'd implement our operations. So that's how the memo kind of came about. And we've been working over the last year to kind of implement that independence that's baked right into that charter. So that's how this all started.
And we talked a few months back, you were going to have the opportunity to hire how many people?
You know, right now we're looking to, in this first wave of hiring, close to 36 staff.
Okay. And so earlier this month, City Council essentially comes out saying, hey, we have to approve it. City Council President's got to sign off on any hires you want to make. Did that surprise you at the time?
You know, it didn't surprise me. And first, I want to make clear, you know, it is, you know, for people who don't know, you know, city governments as the City Council on the one hand, and then you have the city departments and agencies under the mayor. And, you know, for the last year, and the part of the reason that memo came about was, you know, different city departments, not necessarily, you know, following the charter's rules when it came to PAB. And so we've kind of had this over the last year, you know, people not, you know, when we come to hire new staff, propose new positions, you know, PAB not being at, you know, being maybe a part of the conversation, but not having final say over who gets to work for us and how. And so, you know, this has come up a couple times. It came up when we, you know, first were hiring people, first making salary offers. And so when it came up this time, I don't think we were necessarily surprised that there was a hitch, but I think we were surprised at the kind of statement from the city that, you know, we would only be able to nominate candidates for our employees. We wouldn't have final say over salary. We wouldn't have final say over who worked for us, when. So that specific stuff was surprising. But, you know, I think we've been prepared for this, and that's why we, you know, had our attorneys come in and, you know, explain to the city what was happening, and then have, you know, a press conference a few days later to explain to the public that we needed some change. And I'm really glad that we got it.
I mean, it was a Tuesday when City Council was saying, you can't do this. We're going to have to confirm the hires. And then it was a Friday where they walked it back and said, all right, you're right. That moved fast.
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, and, you know, Shawnee hopefully will be on the show a little bit later, but getting a chance to, you know, we've been working on this behind the scenes, trying to work within the bureaucracy for months, you know, trying to play, you know, follow the rules, do this kind of stuff. And you know, we don't like having to come out and do press conferences. We don't like having to, you know, people just want to see us do the work, right? We just want to do the work. We don't want to be able to, you know, get out there, do this and that, you know, making news, but sometimes we have to. And when that happens, every time that's happened where the PABs hit some roadblock, You know, we come to the community speaks up, and things change pretty quickly. And that's what happened last week.
For those thinking, well, what's the big deal here? You've got 36 positions now. You're going to have, what, over 50 eventually hires to make. Why does it matter if city council wants to have final say here, or at least some input? Why does it matter if the city council president needs to sign off on your decisions there? I mean, you're still doing a lot of the work to choose candidates, the recommendations, et cetera. Why does it matter?
You know, if there's anything we've learned in Rochester over the last couple of years, it's that what happens when politics collides with policing, and it happens all the time. What you see is, you know, lack of transparency, maybe wrong decisions getting made, people making decisions not based on justice or truth or what's right, but what's politically, you know, suited for the moment. And we can't have that with PAB. You know, we can't have politicians, you know, saying, you know, this person that you're going to hire, they seem qualified, but they seem a little too aggressive. Or, you know, having a politician say, you know, oh, you know, you shouldn't investigate this because maybe I know the you know, the officer involved. Or maybe they'll say, you know, hey, you know, go after this officer. I really want to see this guy investigated. I'm going to put pressure on you to really, you know, do something about it. And that's not to say that, you know, current city council members are doing anything like that. But it's to say we have to know that that's something that's happened in other communities that have PABs, and we have to really get out ahead of it and make sure it never happens to us. Because the moment that a police officer or a member of the public sees that our work is that kind of political, you know, we just lose credibility and we can't have that.
Okay. And when you mention even what someone is paid, this month's dispute was largely with council. But am I wrong remembering going back earlier this year? I think Mayor Warren even weighed in on what one of your prospective hires was going to be paid.
Yeah, and it gets back to the same issue. You know, it was, and to be clear for the public, you know, the issue is, you know, is the executive director of the PAB the department head, the supervising person, the appointing authority, all these technical terms that mean, you know, the manager for PAB staff. And when you aren't given those kind of titles and treated that way, you don't get a chance to set the salary for your people. You don't get a chance to choose who they are. And so, you know, earlier this year when we were bringing on some folks, you know, PAB wasn't being given that responsibility that's in the charter to kind of make salary offers. And so that's where there was a little bit of a hitch there. And I want to be clear. I don't think that there was necessarily bad intent that people were trying to steal power away from the PAB. I think it was, you know, some misinterpretation that happens. You know, it's a brand new agency. We're getting off the ground. And, you know, I'll just say I appreciate, you know, Deputy Corporation Counsel Patrick Beef, you know, coming out and kind of making a clear statement that, no, you know, PAB is the appointing authority and hiring and supervising. And I think that that has smoothed a lot of things over. Now that city employees see, oh, okay, like the law department says this is the way that it is. So that's really smoothed things over.
So going forward, is this a red flag for you that there will be continued challenges to your autonomy as a board? Is this a concern, whether it's city council, the mayor, this mayor, or the next one? Or do you feel that this was the biggest hurdle and that's largely behind you now?
Well, I think this is a huge hurdle. And the reason I don't think it's a red flag is because, you know, it would be a red flag if nothing had changed. That would be the red flag. But the fact that the city, when we spoke up, when our lawyers kind of let them know what was going on, they did change relatively quickly. I think that's a good sign. And I think it means that the barriers that we know are still ahead, I think we can overcome those too. And, you know, we're still hoping for, more cooperation from RPD when it comes to, you know, allowing us into their world, seeing how policing works. I think we're looking for still more access to information from the city that the charter says we can get. So that's not to say, Evan, that there aren't barriers to come with the city. I think we have to address those before we get to our most important work of investigating complaints. But I do think that this is I just can't say, you know, it was a Friday when the city changed its approach. The next Monday, my job was radically different. You know, the way that I was being treated by city officials, it really changed. You know, so much, you know, conversations that we were now a part of, work that required our approval, signatures on paper, everything changed. And so, again, it's not everything, but it's a huge step forward for PAB.
And so let me ask you then about your work within sort of that kind of the murky nature of politics. And I know you and the PAB want to avoid that as much as you can.
Right.
But it's impossible to always avoid it. I don't know, since June, you know, when Malik Evans defeated Lovely Warren in the Democratic primary, we haven't seen much of the mayor sort of around town. I mean, I'm not saying she's not working. I'm sure she is. It's been a little bit more low key. And I don't know what your relationship has been like with this current mayor, nor do I really know what it's like with Malik Evans likely to be the next mayor. Have things changed at all in recent months since that election? I mean, how would you evaluate your relationships?
Well, you know, I'll say this about Mayor Warren. I think that one of Mayor Warren's largest legacies is going to be fully funding the PAB. And I don't know if there's a lot of politicians that would have done that. And so I think that she deserves a lot of credit for going out on a limb and doing that. And I'll say, you know, about Councilmember Evans, you know, we've had a number of conversations in just in the last couple of weeks about specifically things like autonomy, doing our work. And I think that we are going to have a great deal of, you know, collaboration and cooperation in the months to come. And I really look forward to that. You know, I think Councilmember Evans has come out, you know, he did a whole forum with the Police Accountability Board Alliance, mm-hmm. some of our greatest allies, you know, talking for about an hour, how much he supports our work and how much he's committed to ensuring that we are independent, we can do the work that we need to, you know, within the context of city government. So, you know, I have great hope that come, you know, beginning of next year, with all these hires coming on board, with so much administrative stuff getting figured out, PAB is going to be in a great position to be firing on all cylinders and finally delivering the services our community is expecting of us.
And we'll talk coming up here about how you're going to get there and what these hires, you know, maybe what your timeline is. But before we do that, just talking about political leverage, I mean, and real independence.
Mm-hmm.
We know that when you've got the power to fund a budget, there is often a lot of leverage with that. So when a mayor of any city says, hey, you asked for XYZ, guess what? We're going to give it to you. That could come with the kind of leverage that says, hey, I gave you every cent you looked for, but here's what I need in return. Here's what I expect. Here's the weight that I want to throw around with this. Has that happened with this mayor?
No, Mayor Warren has not done any kind of quid pro quo with us. And you know, I want to be very clear about that. I think almost the opposite is true. You know, the idea that we get this $5 million and then it's really on us to make sure that we spend it. Now, I also want to be clear too. I mean, we got the $5 million, but you can always have your budget cut. You know, and I think that's something we got to be aware of and alert about. You know,
is that something you expect to happen?
I, you know, it's happened to other police accountability boards. You know, in the middle of your budget year, you get cut. You know, someone says either you're not spending your money quick enough, or we don't like the way you're spending your money, or it turns out, you know, oh well, you don't actually get $5 million. You only get, you know, some of the money, and we're going to make you spend a bunch of it on benefits or something, right? So we got to be aware that that could happen. You never know. And that would obviously be extremely detrimental to the PAB. We planned, you know, we released the whole budget proposal. Here's exactly how we'd use $5 million, $4 million on salary, $1 million on this stuff. So we've been working towards all of that. And if we were to get a mid-year budget cut or something, I'd really want to, you know, that would be really devastating for us. But no, you know, that kind of quid pro quo, absolutely not. That has just simply not happened.
Okay, so the example of the kinds of hire you're looking to make, mind if I just read a little bit?
Oh, please.
Connor sent me before the program just an example posting for a case manager position, a civil service title of case officer with a salary range of $48,000 to $62,000. Two openings for this. And starting all throughout the month of October, they're going to be accepting applications. Tell us about what these positions will do.
You know, these are the people that are going to be the front line interacting with our community members and building the bridge between them and our work. So, you know, accepting complaints, following up on complaints, making sure that when you come and say, hey, something happened with the RPD, PAB, can you look into it? You don't just get left for dead. And that's what's happened in Rochester before. I can't tell you how many people will say, yeah, I filed a complaint with RPD and I haven't heard in 6 months. They won't answer my calls. PAB has to be the most responsive city government agency, period. If we want people to trust us, if we want people to work with us in this position, we want people who know our community, are from our community, to fill these jobs so that when people come and the first face that they see at PAB is a case manager, someone who's going to be working with them, they know them, they trust them, they respect them. And so this position is super important for people who are listening to this show, who are from Rochester, to apply for. And I'll say it's two positions for the case manager. We also have a third one that's bilingual required. So you have to be able to, you know, speak read and write Spanish fluently, because again, that's such an important part of our community that we need to have services provided to.
When do you expect to be making hire? You're going to take application throughout the month of October, but realistically, these are just two of three dozen positions. Right. When can you really start hiring?
You know, it depends on some of the positions. For the investigator positions, and those are right now, it's a lot of staff attorneys. It's going to take a little more time because you have to have a few waves of interviews. You have to, the more work you do on the front end for investigations to make sure you have qualified people, the better. So it might take a little bit longer to pull them in. But my hope is November, really, to make some job offers for a lot of our positions to people. You know, this is our primary focus, hiring, getting up quickly. And we've hired consultants specifically to help us with recruiting and interviewing. So, Evan, I really do hope to start bringing people on November, December.
This is the second time we've talked about your hiring on this program, which I appreciate, and I think our listeners too do too, because it indicates you want the public to know exactly what you're doing and how you're going to do it. So on the subject of investigators, which is a huge component of what you're going to do, I want to talk about one case in particular, and then we're going to talk more generally. But it's been sort of interesting is the wrong word, because nobody ever wanted to see what happened with Daniel Prude. I mean, it's tragic what's happened, of course, with Daniel Prude. But the strange sort of confluence is that Daniel Prude dies in March of 2020. September of 2020, we learn about that. It becomes a firestorm, understandably so. It becomes a national story. All throughout that process, PAB is sort of in these nascent stages. So, you know, you're not functioning fully. You don't have a full staff functioning, but you're watching all of this happen. You started your work formally confirmed last November. So all of then the state attorney general, Tish James, comes in. You know, they do their own work. They decide not to charge. All of these things are happening when PAB is sort of in kind of a training wheel phase, like where you're not really able to do what you want to do fully yet. So I guess the first question has been like, what has that been like for you and your colleagues in the PAB to not exactly be in the mix yet, but seeing all of this happening?
It's been the most frustrating thing, Evan. I can't, you know, so many people come up to us, you know, me, my staff, board members, and say, like, here is something horrible that's happening. We need help. So many people in this community need help, and our inability to provide those services immediately kills me. But what would kill us more is acting like we could investigate, like we could interact with these things, when we know we really didn't have the resources or tools or powers to do it. What people have to understand is PAB was nothing before the board members came on. And until I came on board, there was no staff. This is building this agency from the ground up and making it work as quickly as possible. And so, and that's what we have to tell people. It's, you know, we can't do the work quite yet, but seeing the system's failures repeat over and over these last few months, I mean, almost every step in how the city and RPD have treated and gone about dealing with everything from Daniel Prude to, you know, the pepper spraying the 9-year-old, just in terms of informing the public, it's just been abject failure. And watching that happen has both been frustrating, not being able to address it directly, but also spurs everybody at PAB to work harder and move quicker to get to a place where we can actually do the work, because our community so desperately needs it.
Is there any role for PAB in the public discourse about Prude?
You know, I think the most important thing for us to do is talk about the process. You know, when RPD released last week, you know, saying, you know, we've decided to charge Officer Vaughn, but didn't say what the charges were until the next day. And, you know, didn't say what the timeline was, didn't explain why other officers weren't being charged. You know, we have to come out and say that's completely inappropriate. You have to be able to tell the public why you're doing, when you're doing it. And I think they did end up, you know, releasing some of the charges. But, you know, and this gets back a little bit to independence, right? Back a few months ago, City Council, you know, issued a almost unanimous resolution calling for the officers to involved in Daniel Prude's death to be disciplined. So that was a judge, that was a factual finding that, you know, these officers did wrongdoing. And now imagine if, you know, City Council was, you know, supervising hiring PAB staff. Who would trust our judgments about Daniel Prude? Right? We have to be separate from that kind of thing. And at the same time, you know, City Council has to be allowed to do that kind of thing. That's their jobs. You know, but our job has to be those independent investigations. And again, you know, with regards to Daniel Prude, because we can't investigate the specific circumstances, we have to be able to talk about that process. And that's what we will continue to do, is say that the RPD's process around this is just a failure.
Well, so let me read what RPD put out about that.
Yeah, yeah, please.
Because I want to fully understand just where you think they could have done things differently. Quote, the Rochester Police Department's conflict counsel has determined potential grounds for legal recourse in the case of Officer Vaughn as it relates to the March 23rd, 2020 incident. Today, September 23rd, 2021, the RPD served Officer Vaughn with departmental charges. The department fully supports Officer Vaughn's right to due process and to defend himself against the charges of which no predetermined outcome has been put in place. A formal hearing will be scheduled in the future. No other officers have been charged in this matter. RPD remains wholeheartedly committed to reform efforts and taking the necessary action to ensure trust and transparency in the community we are sworn to serve and protect. Several critical steps have been made over the past 17 months, including the launch of the Crisis Intervention Team, new officer training programs, a formal protest response plan, and the release of four revised officer policies that went into effect earlier this year: duty to intervene, chokehold ban, mental hygiene detention, and de-escalation. With the revised use of force and use of force for juveniles going into effect following formal officer training this fall. End quote. RPD later revealed that Vaughn is charged with unnecessary and or excessive force and discourteous and unprofessional conduct. Okay. What do you have wrong with what you heard there?
Let's break it down. So first, you know, when other police accountability boards investigate cases, they release, at the end of the investigation, a report that explains, here's how our investigation worked, here's the evidence we found, here were the rules we were evaluating, whether or not those were broken, and here was our conclusion about what happened. You didn't get any of that from RPD's press release. All you know is that they decided to bring charges against one person. You don't know why.
Not against others.
You don't know why they chose that officer. You don't know why. They didn't explain why it took until, I think, it seems to be the last possible day to file these charges. Normally you have 18 months from the incident to do so. So that's one issue. And then, you know, the Democrat and Chronicle reported about this last week because they talked to the conflict counsel. And, you know, I'm just going to quote him. The press release is a little inaccurate and it could be misinterpreted. My office did not make a determination. We made a recommendation. Whether or not the charges are ultimately preferred against the officer is ultimately a departmental decision. You know, I think the press at least obscures that. You know, at the end of the day, it's the RPD chief that makes these determinations. Let's, you know, accountability is about responsibility. The chief is responsible for making these decisions. Let's not pass it off on conflict counsel or something. It's the chief deciding to bring these charges. So again, there's lack of transparency. There's a lack of accountability and responsibility in that press release. And then there's the end of it, which might be the most important. Because the end of the press release talks about all the policy and procedure changes that RPD has allegedly made to kind of remedy this situation. And those policy and procedure changes, they were created in collaboration with WilmerHale, that law firm that the city paid $250,000 to last year to do some of this stuff. Every time one of those policies or procedures have been released over the last 4 months, whether it's a new chokehold policy, use of force, juvenile handcuffing, it's just that the policy comes out. There's no release of, here's the evidence we use to justify these new policies. Here's exactly how these new rules are different from the last ones. Here's how they will change officer behavior. Come to the training where we will ensure that these officers learn these things. None of that. It's just we've made the changes, trust us. And it's the same thing with the earlier part of the press release. We brought these charges, trust us. And Evan, particularly for, you know, people, I sure a lot of your readers, your listeners, you know, have good reason to have become skeptical of government, especially over the last few years. Why trust the most powerful part of local government when it just says, you don't need the details. Just trust us that we're doing the right thing about these most important issues. And that's just, again, it's unacceptable, and PAB is going to have a completely different process.
Okay, and I understand that criticism because it sort of plays a little bit like when someone is accused of, some sort of racial insensitivity and they say, I went to training. Trust me, I'm different. You know, it's kind of a move to placate. But is it the Police Accountability Board's duty then to say, okay, you are talking about changes to policies regarding duty to intervene, a chokehold ban, mental hygiene detention, de-escalation? We're going to get to the bottom of what you mean by all of those things, and then we will be part of the conversation. Is that going to happen?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, again, it's sequencing. You want to be able to do this with staff, right? Yeah. It's one thing, you know. I think I've done some, you know, media appearances where I talk about the specific problems and failures in a lot of these different policies. But what you want to stop happening in Rochester is shooting from the hip responses, crisis response to everything. You know, let's as quickly as possible, let's look like we're solving the problem. Mm-hmm. No, let's work with the community. Let's get people together. Let's use evidence-based, tested solutions and get things done that way. And so that's what we're really looking forward to doing. But on all these things, yes, it is. Here's the thing. You know, PAB, people often think our responsibility is just to investigate police misconduct. Or some people just think we're just supposed to discipline police officers. That's not the case. We're supposed to bring systemic transparency and change to the Rochester Police Department. And if that's not about culture, policy, and procedure, looking at that, then we will have failed our work.
As the executive director of the PAB, this may be partially in your lane, fully in your lane, not fully in your lane, but de-escalation is the term that the Rochester Police Department used in their release. That is highly debated. It's important, the notion of whether de-escalation is consistently achievable, how you train somebody for that. But just that word, that blanket term, it doesn't mean much. We've had conversations with trainers, police trainers, former officers, and de-escalation means so many different things. And the training can be really extensive and or it can be sort of perfunctory. So how important is that term in there to you?
I don't know how important it is in there. I don't know how to say that. But I will say is that you're absolutely right in that having just a term thrown around without more, of course, that gets to the root of so much of what's problematic about our current policing system, whether it's terms like use of force, de-escalation, crisis response. In the context of policing, what these terms actually mean, they're so vague, right? They can mean so many different things. And unless we have specificity, and this is something that just characterizes so much of RPD's new policies and procedures, you actually sit down and read them, it's hard to know what they mean. What is it, you know, what does the word reasonable mean?
Is that intentional, do you think?
You know, yes. Here's the fundamental tension in policing. Management and the community often want police officers to have their roles highly restricted. At the same time, officers and a lot of people in the public want officers to have the discretion to respond to emergency situations, fast-acting situations. And a way that many departments kind of balance these tensions is by writing rules and saying these rules will constrain, by having the actual details of the rules have so much flexibility and vagueness to allow officers to have that flexibility. And this is part of the reason why officers often feel that charges brought against officers are political. Because the rules are so vague, someone could say, oh yeah, you violated the rule on one day, and the next day say, no, you did the right thing. And so this vagueness in these terms, again, I think it's intentional. I think it's part of the culture, but it's also problematic, hugely problematic. And that's going to be a central tension, I think, in the years to come is, how do we have rules that actually guide police behavior appropriately, give people the flexibility to do their jobs, but also give the public a real sense of, oh, okay, this is what officers are supposed to do and what they're not allowed to do. And right now with these current rules, we don't have that.
Okay, and so last point on this, and then we're going to welcome in the chair of the Accountability Board, Shawnee Wilson. Connor, when you say, hey, this release, it cites the Rochester Police Department's conflict counsel determining charges against Officer Vaughn in the Daniel Prude case. You know, it shouldn't just be put at their doorstep here. Is all of this down to the chief? I mean, does it all come back to having a chief that wants to be transparent, that is communicating freely, that cares about accountability?
No.
Not just about the chief.
I wish I could say it is, because that would be such an easy fix. Let's just go find a chief who hits all the boxes, right? And that's what so many communities are led to believe. We just need a good chief. But the systemic issues are overwhelming in almost every police department. And I think, again, I mean, of course, you know, a good chief can do a lot of good things for a department. But you got to be realistic. One person cannot change this system. Even, you know, even I can't. You know, this is part of the reason I'm hiring staff. But you know, we have to understand that whether it's a mayor, a police chief, even senior staff in a police department, There's so much control coming from the bottom up. There's so much institutional culture that's been there for almost 100 years. And expecting one person to overcome that, that's not realistic.
I don't ask this to be provocative. I'm just curious to know, then, how is your relationship with the current chief, and do you feel that there is a real effort at transparency?
You know, I think, I'll be honest, I think that Chief Harriet Sullivan has been thrust into an exceptionally difficult circumstance.
There's no question about that.
And so I don't know if anybody could have truly succeeded in hitting all the boxes in her role. I really don't. And so, you know, I don't think that I'm in a position to give Chief Harriet Sullivan a grade on this stuff. What I will say is that the most important thing, I think one of the most important things for, you know, whoever the next mayor is to think hard, not only about how do you select the appropriate police chief, command staff, but how to be realistic about knowing that that choice alone is not going to solve the problems. I think that's really important because a lot of mayors truly think that just having the right police chief is going to solve it. And we can't say that's going
to
happen here.
I respect your reticence to offer a grade. I understand that. But it does sound like you think that this release and the way they've been communicating about what they're doing with Officer Vaughn and not doing with other officers in the wake of the Daniel Prude case is not enough.
Yeah, no, it's not enough. And I don't want to hold back on some of the criticism here. I just want to make sure that it's located in the right place. City government is this very intertwined thing where the law department and the police department, you know, and different parts of city government, the communications department, you know, anything that they all work together in lots of ways. And so locating responsibility can be difficult, but I'll say there's lots of places where RPD still needs to step up. You know, the law says that we're supposed to be able to access and look at RPD training to be able to attend these things. RPD hasn't allowed PAB staff or board members to attend trainings all year. I mean, that's just unacceptable, right? And that is something that has to change.
What does the chief say about that?
I'll tell you what Tim Curtin told me. You know, Tim Curtin just...
City attorney.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. He's a city... What is? I can't even remember his
corporation
position.
Corporation council? He was?
He was corporation council.
What
now
is
he's
now?
Just council to the mayor, I think.
Yeah.
I don't... he resigned as corporation council one day, got hired in the new position the next. But, you know, I remember Tim Curtin just saying, you know, that it doesn't... You know, that's... You don't have access. I don't interpret the charter that way. Even though the charter, you can read it, says access to RPD trainings. I mean, it's just right there. And so, you know, again, talking about responsibility, if you are the police chief and, you know, the head lawyer for the city says, oh, this is what the laws say. You don't have to, you know, cooperate. You don't have to do X, Y, or Z. What I'm trying to say is that responsibility has to be appropriately located here. And I think you have systemic issues. So that's what I'm trying to get across, Evan.
Let's take our only break of the hour with Connor Dwyer Reynolds, the Executive Director of the Rochester Police Accountability Board. We're going to welcome in the chair of the PAB on the other side of this break. We'll talk a little bit more about, I've long been confused about why police departments don't want us to see how they train, what their the source of their training material is, who they're hiring to do that. I would think, number one, they would want that. But also, I think we ought to demand that, as Bill Johnson and the Raise Commission has said, as the PAB has said. I mean, this is basic. How are the officers who are supposed to protect the public being trained? Why is that? I'm curious to know what Johnny Wilson says. We'll talk about that. We're going to close the hour just by talking about really the coming months for the PAB. They got over a big hurdle this month in regards to hiring autonomy, and we'll talk more about that coming up. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Miroslav Marinovich, the author of the new memoir called The Universe Behind Barbed Wire. He was a Ukrainian-Soviet dissident sent to the Gulag in 1978. His new memoir is about his vision for a world without totalitarianism, without communism, and with real human rights. But accountability must come first, and we'll talk about his story next hour.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Shawnee Wilson is the chair of the Police Accountability Board and is with us on the line. Shawnee, thanks for making time for the program. How are you?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me, guys.
And Shawnee, as we talked about earlier this hour, there was a I would call it a brief little blip of controversy compared to a lot of the controversies in policing locally. But just to kind of refresh listeners, earlier this month, City Council essentially puts forward the position that, hey, the PAB, you can make recommendations for hiring, but we're going to confirm. We're going to have the final say. PAB comes back and says that is the opposite of independence. There's some legal pushback back and forth. We go for about 3 days and then it was over. Loretta Scott, a city council, came out and said, no, you're right. You're going to have the independence. And Connor Dwyer Reynolds has said that was a very, very important point and a big hurdle to true autonomy here. How do you feel about that, Shani?
Yeah. I think that is correct. I think that was a huge hurdle. I know that we are constantly concerned about, and you just were talking to, you know, Connor about the idea of transparency and, you know, the belief that we should have a completely independent accountability system that is outside of city government to a degree and also outside of the police department, right? And, you know, we have to make sure that that's possible, right? And that means that, you know, one of the things we said in the press conference was we are going to have to operate outside of the fear of retribution. And I think that, you know, the fight was that, you know, there were some misunderstandings about what the charter said about how we can actually operate. And so I'm really glad that actually was addressed finally, and I'm glad that we're now able to move forward.
We talked a little bit, Shani, about the Rochester Police Department notifying the public that Officer Vaughn was potentially facing charges over the Daniel Prude incident, but no other officers would be. We talked about what it means to communicate with the public about something so important in a way that is complete and transparent, as opposed to sort of clipped and a little bit more opaque and a little bit more PR spin. What did you make of what you saw?
So I agree with Connor. I think that it was not transparent enough. I know that there were a lot of folks that had questions for me across the city. And, you know, just like the rest of them, we are all just confused about what's going on. You know, to just talk about a point that you all were talking about before I jumped on with you, that there is, you know, the culture of policing is surrounded in this type of gray area, this mist, right? And I think it's really just about catching up and trying to figure out what you're going to do next before you do it. And I wonder if that's part of the culture as well. So there's just this culture of, you know, we don't necessarily know what's happening until it happens. And then we're just going to inform everybody in that space, right? Like, it's like you're like running next to a car and then you jump into it. And I think that's probably what you saw there. But I do know this, that, you know, police accountability is impossible without transparency. And we have to have a system that people can rely on. And I think that the actual press release just had more questions than answers. And I just heard a lot of frustration from the public regarding that.
Shani and Connor, I want to ask you both about one aspect of at least why I see transparency on police training to be important. And I am curious to know what you make of it. And then I'm going to get some listener feedback here. There's been some interesting reporting on police training across the country when people can get information on who's doing the training. And training can look very, very different from city to city, county to county, state to state. There's a lot of different stuff out there. And some of it is pretty militaristic. I mean, we know that in some places, police officers, new recruits, new hires, I mean, they come right in and they're shown some really graphic stuff. Some really grisly, violent stuff. And they are told, you know, this could be you if you're not careful. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but it's a very violent set of images right from the jump for new hires. And it builds and it sort of inculcates this idea that, well, I'm at war now. Whereas other training is much more about extensive efforts at de-escalation, just a different focus. And so when I say I would want people to know, I think anybody who takes our tax dollars should let us see how they're going to spend it for the most part. I think we have a right to know how police are being trained. But I also, there's a part of me that might empathize with officers at least a little if the training is all about how violent your life is about to be and what a target you're supposed to be. I'm not saying it's okay that we have really, you know, over the top certain interactions, but I do want some context here. And this is, I think this will be important going forward. Let me ask Connor first. What do you think, Connor?
No, absolutely. I think there's a great book. If you know, people don't want to spend a million years learning about police culture, it's John Crank's Understanding Police Culture. Really encourage people to go get it. It's a little academic, but boy, did he do a lot of field research on this stuff. And research like John's shows that policing culture is so oriented around the fear of violence. You know, both, you know, fearing it coming towards you and feeling of having to have conflicts where there will be violence and you have to participate in. And that's a dark place to be in. And we ask police officers to do that. Every day we train them to be prepared to deal with this exceptionally dark part of our world. And so policing world, it's, you have to, it is training and preparing you to be involved in this really tough world. And, you know, I think part of the reason there's so much secrecy around police culture is unless there's a fear that unless you fully understand what we ask officers to do, unless you fully understand the darkness of the world that we're sending them into, you're going to get a misperception. You're going to think, oh, these people are like violent thugs or something, right? If you don't see the full picture, that's a fear. That's a, you know, I've heard, you know, officers have told me.
They've expressed that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, if you don't understand everything, you're going to misperceive us.
Okay.
And so that's a legitimate concern, right? So you can understand why. And like, well, if you just see a little bit of our training and you think, wow, that seems really disturbing or graphic or whatever, but you've missed the broader context of all of this, then, you know, you're not going to really understand our work. And I felt, you know, lots of officers want transparency and training. Don't get me wrong. But I think if we're explaining why this is the case, I certainly think what you're getting at, Evan, is a big part of it.
Why that opacity is there. Okay, I take the point, but just open the doors for the training. To me, it should be simple.
Absolutely.
There should be transparency for all of it, and therefore we can get the full picture of context.
And that's exactly right. I think it benefits officers. If, you know, so much of what officers say now is you can't understand where we're coming from on this stuff. Let us understand.
Yeah.
Let us in. Show us. Because if really it is true that all these things are happening, we're going to have a better response to policing as a result, right?
I would think so. Shawnee Wilson, what do you think?
Yeah, so I would say as a clinician, I think that the amount of violence that police are exposed to in a day is staggering. I don't have a number for you. You know, I think that I agree. You know, it, as a clinician, we have a certain amount of training that we do per year in order to make sure that we can do our jobs. And, you know, now you're seeing the mental health crisis that is happening nationally, internationally from just COVID response, right? So I think that when you open up your training to the public so that the public can see what you're doing, I also think it's accountability. And also to also say the same thing as Connor saying, it just gives a greater depth of understanding. But also, you know, it also says, okay, well, if you're going to respond to a domestic violence call and you only are addressing one factor in domestic violence, then you're really not getting the full picture. And so those are the ways that I hope that police departments, our police department, will open up that conversation around training. You know, the fact that we were not allowed to attend these trainings was really upsetting and sad to hear, especially since all of our board are community members. And so we're really curious about how the police are trained, right? So I think that, and especially too, when you're inundated with these images starting out, it's really, you automatically put people in a place of fear, right? And so what do people do when they're afraid? You know, they respond, and they respond in a negative way most times. And so I'm really hoping that can be a conversation that we have, mm-hmm. and that we can see that change.
All right, let me rip through as much feedback as I can. There's a bunch here. Diane says, how can the RPD Conflict Council be hired to do an independent external audit of the Pruitt investigation and make recommendations? They will represent RPD in discipline hearings. Are investigation report and details released to the public or foilable? Connor?
That's a great question. It's a complex one. I'll simplify by saying, you know, whether or not something is foilable under the law and whether or not the city of Rochester will release it are very different questions.
Let me interrupt and just say, sometimes we, this is media speak.
Oh.
Foilable, I should do this too. It just means freedom of information law. It just means, can we, if you want to foil something, you're putting in a notice to government that you want records released publicly. Okay.
That's right. Thank you, Evan. No, I mean, conflict counsel, you know, I don't want to comment on the specifics of all that, but what I will say is that my hope is that PAB can take on as much of these responsibilities with regards to investigation, et cetera, as possible, so people don't have to worry about these quandaries. This is our role, to remove that conflict of interest.
Okay. Shani, you want to add to that?
I don't really have much to add. I think that, you know, one of the, which is why I'm so excited about the work that we're going to be doing, is that we can examine training and then recommend changes. And I think that that's where the community response needs to come in. And that's why, you know, I think that the community will be able to add a real richness to how police are actually trained. And I'm hoping that that can actually be a conversation. But that also, remember, has to happen at the state level. So that can even be a bigger conversation, right, folks? Because we even have state level training that we even have to worry about as well. And that's a lot of things we hear from police, right?
All right. I'm not sure you, both of you can address this, but Carly says there have been several, I think four civilian deaths at the hands of RPD this year. And I don't know if that's exactly right, but Carly's thinking it's around four. She says, what are your guest opinions about RPD's handling of these incidents since Daniel Prude? I know that's a kind of a broad one, Connor. Go ahead.
What I'll say is that we need better and we need more. You know, we were talking earlier, Evan, about the incidents that really frustrate us, and every single one of these deaths is an incident that PAB should be looking into. And it's just, again, spurs us to focus on, can we, you know, put in those nights and weekends to move faster, because we can't, again, you know, RPD could do the most perfect thing in the world, but there's that conflict of interest. Investigating yourselves, you know, telling the public, you need an independent voice saying this is what actually happened. Was it right? Was it wrong? And that's a role only PAB can play.
Okay. Shani Wilson?
Yeah, I don't have much to add there. I think that's a perfect statement.
Well, speaking of then, Connor, just remind people, because we talked about where you are in hiring some of the first positions, but when it comes to investigators and more, how can people get in touch with you, and who are you looking for?
Okay, so first, as of tomorrow, we are launching our new website, rocpab.org. That's rocpab.org. It's a one-stop shop to learn about everything PAB and look at all of the positions on our website. We're doing a little bit of preview here. The positions formally get posted on October 1st, but tomorrow you'll be able to look at the website. We'll make sure that it's on Connections website, too. People can link to it, look at it. We are looking for local people. We are looking for staff who reflect the diversity of Rochester. So we are, you know, if you're a black and brown resident of Rochester, if you have a disability, if you're, you know, gender nonconforming, whoever you are, we want you at our PAB. And there's a position for you. We need an IT director. We need investigators. We need attorneys, senior, entry level, et cetera. We need case managers. We need community engagement people. We need a press secretary. So if you have experience in local media, we want you to apply. Evan, if you need another job, man. We happen to have you. These are all the things that we're looking for. And again, rockpab.org starting tomorrow, rocpab.org. We're hiring throughout the month of October. And there will be future jobs to come. We'll have more investigator positions coming up later this year, too. So we are, we are hiring a lot of people, and we need you and you, the people that you know in Rochester.
Shani Wilson, Mike writes to say, I've lived in the city for my entire life. What is the board doing to make me safe? It seems to me they care more about criminals than law-abiding citizens. Shani.
Ooh, that's a great question. What am I doing to keep you safe? What are we doing to keep you safe? Well, I guess I would answer that by saying we're giving you a voice. We're giving you a seat at the table. You know, it's PAB is not just about quote-unquote criminals. PAB is about people. That's about the police and about you, and about the people that are being directly affected by what police do. So by giving the community a voice about how they're policed, that is the best thing we can do to keep you safe.
Connor Dwyer Reynolds.
You can't say it better. That's why Shani's the chair of the board.
And lastly, John Paul writes, and again, this may be a whole other show, what are your guest opinions about shoot-to-kill training as opposed to wounding? Let me say... Connor, I find that to be a hard one because as someone who's not trained as a police officer, I was one of those people who kind of thought, well, do you have to shoot for center mass or whatever? I understand why police say they do. It makes more sense. It's a bigger target, less collateral damage, takes down a target more if there's a threat. To me, a larger question, and I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about that on a separate show, but to me, the bigger question is, are we drawing firearms too often to begin with? And what are the standards for when that is justified? But I think that the questions are at least interesting and fair.
They are, and I'll just say in the context of the Open Door Mission shooting, which happened earlier this year, so much of the question was around shoot-to-kill training. But these broader questions of why were we in a situation where officers had to shoot someone in the first place? We always talk about, this is something Moses Robinson talks about all the time, prevention, et cetera. What are the policies and procedures of the Rochester Police Department that could prevent them from drawing a gun in the first place? Beanbag rounds, way we deploy people, et cetera, mental health calls, whatever. That should be our primary focus. And of course, we still want to talk about shoot to kill, but those issues are just as pressing.
Okay, 20 seconds, Shani, what do you want to add there?
I don't really have anything to add there, Evan. I think that's a perfect, I don't want to add anything.
Okay, that's fine. As we close the hour here, listeners, I'll say it again. It's rockpab.org that launches tomorrow. Mm-hmm. They've got a lot of hiring to do coming up here. And, you know, as we've kind of talked about this hour with the police talking about discipline in the wake of the Prude case, this is a PAB that's been itching to get to work, and the hires that they're about to be doing will help them put them in that direction. So please keep coming back here and talking to us, and because we talk about transparency with the police, transparency with the PAB matters.
That's right.
I very much believe that. Right. So thank you for being here.
Any question you want to answer, we'll be here, Evan. Thanks
Rock
so much PAB. For having us.
You got it, Shani Wilson. Thank you, Shani.
Take care.
And we're going to talk to Shani, I hope, sooner than later on this program, too, because her work in health and public health matters, and a lot of hats that they're wearing in this community. She's not even paid for PAB. More coming up on Connections.